Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Linda Cheek, founder of Doctors of Courage and a physician who has also been targeted by the DEA. She is a well-known thought leader in the space of physician empowerment and has many views on policies ranging from the CDC opioid guidelines to the Controlled Substance Act. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Cheek.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate you having me. It's been about a year and a half since I was on. Not much has changed in that time, so hopefully we can get started on making some change.
Unfortunately, that is the case. And today, I want to talk about the Controlled Substance Act.
Yes.
A statute that you're very familiar with. For the audience who may not be as intimately aware of the Controlled Substance Act, can you talk a little bit about the statute itself, why it's called a statute, and why it impacts physicians so much today?
Okay, that's a pretty big bite right there. The Controlled Substance Act is actually a law, although it is still called an act. It was an act up until 1970, and then Richard Nixon established it as a law. I learned about it actually while I was incarcerated. I've spent a lot of my time in the law library because I was curious as to how I, an innocent doctor, could be found guilty in our society today, in our justice system. The problem is most of Americans feel like the justice system is a just system, and it's not. So I spent a lot of time and I completely read and reread the Controlled Substance Act. And the entire act is designed to go after illegal drug cartels offshore, Mexican cartels, Colombian cartels, to be able to confiscate their money. That's the whole point of it. And when you read it, every single line in there is pointing to getting drugs that are coming from offshore, using particular laws, or particular, not laws, but particular avenues of attack, using the military and so on. This is basically a law that was designed for taking out and getting the money from these cartels. But what happened was in the late 1990s, 1999, Congress actually brought the DEA in for a session, evaluation, and basically decided that the DEA wasn't bringing home the bacon as they were supposed to do using this law. And so a few really smart J officials, Glenn Fine, the IG of the time, decided that actually prescription drugs were good opportunity to go after. And so they basically made prescription drugs sound things like the Taliban. They used really propagandizing terms to actually make opiate drugs look bad to the American people. So they propagandized it since 1999, 2002, and then it just grew and grew till now. Pretty much all Americans believe that opioids cause addiction. And it was purely a government agenda to use the Controlled Substance Act against prescription drugs and against doctors. Now, the other thing is, in 1984, what really made this even more impact to attack doctors was in 1984, Reagan signed in the law that allowed the confiscation of assets for anyone who was drug-related. And so this actually then, what the DEA decided they could do, and the DOJ, because they're one and the same, basically. One is a smaller agency of the other, decided that they could actually then confiscate doctors' assets by simply saying, these doctors are pushing drugs, and that they can then confiscate their asset, which they do. They do that still today. And basically, they go in and basically anything the doctor owns, from a boat to his house to any savings accounts that he has, all get confiscated. So the doctor literally is, from the time of attack, basically has zero income, can't afford an attorney, and is basically just meat hanging in the freezer to the DOJ.
Now, let's break that down a little bit, because I think it's a lot for people to digest.
I think so,
and
too.
I think I gave you a big question and you gave a big response. And I think for the listening public, it would make sense to break things down.
Okay.
So let's start by talking about civil asset forfeitures in 1984 Reagan, which is what you ended with. I want to add the caveat that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, is not a self-funded agency. They require funding to come from their activities on an annual basis to maintain their budget. Now, For somebody who may be looking at us a bit incredulously and say, how can you just say the DEA is targeting physicians? You must have a bias. And clearly from our perspectives and our lived experiences, we would be right to say that there is some degree of bias, but there's a greater degree of truth in what we're saying. For those listening, can you parse it down as granularly as possible between the notion of a civil asset forfeiture, what a DEA agent can get from a physician-related conviction versus a traditional drug cartel-related conviction?
Most of the drug cartel money is offshore. So the government really has not been able to confiscate cartel money, even though that was what their purpose was in the beginning. So there's really been very little money. Even with, there was one cartel boss that we did put in prison a few years back, and I don't remember his name now, but they weren't able to confiscate any money. So in the 1999 era and 2000 era, when they started going after doctors, and they found out that doctors do have assets, doctors are writing prescription drugs, and all their assets are in nice American banks and or property that can be confiscated. So it really just, we really just became easy targets. It's pure and simple.
So now let's talk a little bit about Ruan, the Supreme Court case that required a mens rea mandate or a criminal intent to be demonstrated among physicians. It does two things, and I'd like to get your opinion on both. One, highlight just how widespread and contentious this issue is of DEA targeting physicians, one. And then two, how the interpretation of laws can impact its implementation. And within that, there's an entire area of uncertainty. We can speculate on the intent behind some of the DEA agents, but I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of uncertainty in how those statutes have been interpreted, and the Supreme Court had to come in to help provide some clarity, but it hasn't really changed much. So talk a little bit about the enormity of the problem before Ruan and what you're seeing now post-Ruan regarding physicians being targeted and the interpretation of the Controlled Substance Act.
Okay. I really don't see any difference. The Ruan, and I predicted that Ruan would not really make a difference, mainly because our government is basically, especially the Department of Justice, is now rogue and basically can do whatever they are ignoring Ruan. They are still attacking doctors. They are still raiding offices. They are still going after anyone that they target. And doctors that have been targeted just even since last June are still taking pleas. They're still being forced into it. So Ruan has really not made any difference. It's made a difference in about five doctors' lives. And those are the doctors that were actually put before the Supreme Court and a few other doctors that had attorneys that were involved in the Supreme filing. But other than that, really, it's not going to help very many people at all, mainly because of the fact that the DEA and the DOJ can do whatever they want. And at Kovanaugh's, when he was before the Congress to make him a justice, he basically said, most of all of the congressional legislators say, we don't run the government anymore, agencies do. And that's basically bottom line what it is now. And they can do it with pure immunity, so they can break the law, they can do whatever they want, and they can get away with it, and there is no retribution for what they do. So I don't really predict Ruan making much of a difference. And there's a lot of doctors out there that don't have the mens rea approach. And also the other thing is retroactive. If a doctor is incarcerated now because of the Controlled Substance Act, they have to go completely through the process of the court again with declaring a 2255, which is inadequate counsel, showing the law has changed. And all this does is just put more money into the pockets of the lawyers. It really is not going to help the doctors out that much.
So talk a little bit about the pressures the DEA and the DOJ are facing. There's a big movement for harm reduction, for providing access to care, especially at the grassroots level. Do you see that permeating federal legislators, either in the Congress or in the Senate, or do you still feel like it's falling on empty ears?
I feel like it's falling on empty ears. I really don't see anything that's of any consequence. As long as we have the Controlled Substance Act, doctors will be attacked because that's where the money is. And that's what's, like you say, funding the DEA, funding the government. It basically funds most all of law enforcement, all the way from the local law enforcement. Even they have in their budgets money that they get from the confiscation of doctors' assets. And it's easy. When I was at a pain management conference at Case Western in 2004, when we were going through this, and this was very early on in the stage of all this happening, the former U.S. attorney that was there teaching us about the law basically said, "Why do you think the DEA and the DOJ are attacking doctors?" And no one in the room could answer her question. And she came up with the right answer, because that's where the money is and the guns aren't.
That's interesting. I think people still have trouble understanding the flow of money, how it circulates from a conviction back into the budgets of law enforcement. Can you provide a little bit of clarity on how that works and how the CSA enables that cycle? Because I think it's very important for people to understand that, because when people say it's about the money, oftentimes what happens is people will say, "Oh, sour grapes," or, "Oh, you're delving into conspiracy." But there's a formal process by which the money is recirculated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm really not sure how that's done, because they really pretty much keep it under wraps. But if you look at every press release, any press release where they say, "And we thank the following organizations for their help in this indictment," or whatever, and they list everything from city, county law enforcement, state law enforcement, FBI, DOJ, CMS, which is basically, sorry for all the acronyms for people out there, like Medicare, Medicaid, the FBI, that acronym, and so on. And they thank all of these organizations. Each of those organizations named gets a portion, gets a bit of the income that they make when they confiscate the doctor's assets. I do not know how they get it. I just know that they do get it.
Interesting. So now let's transition and talk about solutions, more in a positive vein. You have some suggestions on what physicians can do to protect themselves, protect their livelihood. Can you share with the audience what you feel physicians should do in this climate, particularly of medical McCarthyism?
You're not going to like this, Jay.
Yeah.
Basically, the only thing that I consider that a doctor can do to protect himself is to not prescribe a single controlled substance, period. They are attacking doctors, in my first, like I said, a year and a half ago, attacking doctors for prescribing 2 Lortabs. They're now prescribing doctors for prescribing Suboxone. If they have a doctor out there that is compassionate, that is elderly, that is a minority, they go after certain targets, and/or taking care of the rural population, the populations of people they'd rather see dead than alive, they will attack anyone. No one is immune. And doctors who think, "I'm doing everything right," the problem is when they find out that they're being attacked, then they go, "How could this happen? I've been doing everything right." But I did everything right, and I was a victim. There's no way around it. Until we get the Controlled Substance Act repealed, no doctor is safe that writes a single controlled substance.
So let's talk about that, repealing a federal law. How does that work, and what are the steps required to get that done?
Okay. You basically have to the legislature has to put in an amendment to the 20 Act, whatever it's called, the U.S.
Criminal
USC, statute 21, that basically says these statutes are repealed. And then, of course, we also need compensation. We need to have in that repeal, we need to have a statement that anyone that has been incarcerated based on this law need to be immediately released. And all those doctors, even those that have been released, that have been indicted and convicted by this law, need to have their records completely exonerated and basically wiped clean. I'm not a big legal person, so I can't tell you all the correct lingo on this, but that's basically what we need. It just has to come out of the legislature. And we have a few bills in the past, we had a House resolution come out in the past that actually was a step towards getting the CSA repealed. And we basically just need to teach them the reason for it, and that is what I teach. There is no drug that causes addiction. And the idea that drugs are the cause of addiction is something that has been basically put into our minds through propaganda simply so they can attack us. So that, because that's why the juries convict us, because they believe, oh, the doctor is writing opioids. Opioids cause addiction, so the doctor is a drug pusher, and they get convicted even when all of the evidence is in the doctor's favor. We just have to teach people, and that's what I've been trying to do now for 6 years, and I'm really not getting anywhere, and I'm not exactly sure why. If anybody out there has the answer as to why my teaching is not being taken to heart and learned and passed on, then I'd appreciate knowing that. Maybe if I can take it from a different approach or whatever, I don't know. It's pretty easy to understand when you understand the science of addiction. And of course, that's not through conventional medicine. Conventional medicine does not explain addiction. And that's probably the problem people have understanding me, is because I do not explain it with conventional medicine.
So let's talk about that, because I think that's very important. You take the issues of abortion, gun control, any of these seemingly controversial, whether you want to acknowledge them to be controversial or not, in some populations, they are deemed controversial. There's always a strong push from the medical community to do what is considered medically right. You don't have that when it comes to pain, substance use dependency, addiction. There's a screaming silence in pain and addiction anytime anything is related to opioids. And I feel like that's almost the heart of the problem, where there's no support from the traditional powers that be within the medical community. And what you're suggesting is that the medical institutions themselves misunderstand addiction, and that's part of the problem.
We've called people addicts ever since the 1800s, after the Civil War, and they invented morphine, and the Civil War veterans got shots of morphine and took it, and they of course became dependent on it. So they've equated dependency with addiction ever since that. They've come up with several kind of explanations as to addiction. Now, right now, the latest thing is it's a brain disease. But this is just the way conventional medicine works. Someone out there in some prestigious position at some Harvard University or whatever will come up with an idea, and that idea catches on, and people then start believing it as reality. So this brain disease concept is just something that somebody has put out there. There's no evidence of it being a brain disease, because it's not. It's a disease of toxicity. Problem is, toxicity is not a subject that conventional medicine understands nor uses. The problem is, we've equated over the course of 100 or plus years dependency with addiction. And basically, the laws back in the early 1900s were used against people who were simply dependent on opioids because they had problems. And now, today, we're doing the same thing. People need opioids to cover their pain. Most of the time, their pain is actually caused by conventional medicine, because it doesn't address the cause of the pain. And people end up on opioids. But then, if you take the opioids away, then, you know, their pain is excruciating, in which case nowadays, because so many doctors are scared to treat, and for good reason, obviously, then, and also the government has limited how many opioids a person can get through various techniques that they've used, and they've also limited the number of opioids available, which they are going to continue to do. That's another topic. Going to continue to limit the opioids to where there's fewer and fewer available. And people are suffering, and then they're taking the route out to commit suicide to help relieve their pain, taking a temporary problem and turning it into a permanent solution. So it's the conventional medicine does not have the answer to very much of anything. They have a lot of, because they depend on pharmaceuticals, and what they do is they simply stop the symptoms of something. They cover up the symptoms. So then you think that the problem is solved, but it's really not. It's still underlying in the body and continues to grow.
So who in positions of power can we turn to? Who are the folks that will listen to us and give us some degree of representation?
We have to teach the general population, the real cause of drug of addiction, so that they, number one, if they're sitting in a jury box, they stop convicting doctors based on the he's wearing a white coat and he's a drug pusher concept. If we can stop the convictions at the in the courtroom, number one, that kind of cuts down the use of the DEA and the DOJ against doctors. They'll probably then look for some other avenue for making money. But that's really a long approach. It would take some time. But we need to also be teaching the legislators. And I've been working on that for the last 7 years, and they don't seem to be caring to learn, mainly because I guess they're only hearing it from me. Maybe if they would hear it from everybody else out there in the country and say, addiction is not caused by opioids, and here's the real cause, and that's what I try to teach people that they need to do and take that message to the legislators. So then, and the other thing, what the way I would approach the legislators now is the cost. They are, what you need to do is figure out what legislators are interested in. Two things right now, money and border. And both things are fixed by taking the Controlled Substance Act and repealing it. Because money, that look at the billions of dollars that are being spent on chasing rabbits, trying to come up with things that aren't really going to help the addiction problem. All of the putting money out there to help people with addiction, if they're not, and that's what they're doing is just maintaining the addiction. They're not curing it. And then the second thing is the border issue. If we were to legalize drugs, if we were to have every drug in the country legal, number one, then the people in Latin America would not have to be trying to come to America. Number one, they could be raising these herbs and producing them for sale through proper channels, through FDA channels. I'm sure they would not want to leave their country of origin if they didn't have to. Most of them are being forced out because of fear of being attacked by the cartels. So if you legalize drugs, you basically have jerked the entire income market out from under the cartels. The other thing that when you make a drug illegal, is it starts increasing the strength of that drug. If you look at prohibition, for example, when alcohol was prohibited in the 1930s, what did you end up having? Everybody was making moonshine, 100 proof. And then you ended up having wood alcohol, which was poison. So now we're seeing that same thing today. We see it in marijuana. Marijuana in the early days, when it was first used, had a 2%, 2 to 3% THC, which is the high that you get from marijuana.
Active ingredient,
right. And now it's up to 30%. If you look at cocaine back in the 1800s, was simply coca leaves that were chopped up. And of course, Coca-Cola had cocaine in it. It was a mild stimulant. So what is it now? It's crack and all the very strong cocaine products that they have today. So if you were to legalize drugs and put them under FDA approval, they could be sold over the counter. They could go back to a useful strength for what they are designed for, and yet not be abused, and they would also not end up with poisonous varieties like we have now with the carfentanil and so on, that we have all the analogs of fentanyl that we now have in the pills that people are getting over the street. So that caught with the Controlled Substance Act being repealed, we would have taxes. We would be able to tax all that, so the government would be making income. They would not have to be feeding all of this cost into attacking doctors and chasing drug people and all that. Save all that income, save all that money, make money with the taxes. And I think that is the approach that we need to go with the legislators, is the money approach and the what was the second thing that I mentioned? Money and the border issue, yeah.
Yeah. So let's touch on this, because I've heard this argument before. And you laid it out pretty expansively, and thank you for that. The argument that I've heard federal officials make against what you just said was, if we legalize drugs, there will still be a black market that would undercut the legal market. They seem to maintain this supply and demand-oriented approach to drug use, looking at it as if it were any other market like candy or lettuce, what have you. But dependency, addiction, proper use of certain medications, in different ways. You don't look at it in economic terms. So for the federal agent or the federal agency that says we can only look at drug abuse economically in terms of supply and demand. If we legalize drugs, we will undercut, there will still be a black market that undercuts the legal market. What is your response to them?
I think that would be very minimal. I think with a legalization of drugs, we would even lose the gangs that we have in America. Jones, forget his first name, you can help me here. The DEA agent from years ago, and I actually have a video of him on my website. Mr. Jones even mentioned that before we made drugs illegal, there were no gangs. And gangs actually were created because of the illegal market. And I do not think that if we have legal over-the-counter drugs that are a consistency and good strength for what people would need for whatever they might want, just like coffee and just anything else that would be available over-the-counter, that people would choose those simply because they're safe. I don't see that they would be choosing illegal drugs and going off onto the street to, if the cartels are going to come up with cheaper drugs on the street, you can better believe they're probably going to be tainted and they're going to be dangerous, and hopefully people would steer clear of those with proper FDA-approved drugs on the counter.
Certainly. With the remaining time that we have, Dr. Cheek, I'd like to get your thoughts on what are some immediate solutions we as a public, we in the healthcare world, can implement to at least make some degree of improvement for patients, for physicians, and their families. What are some easy wins that you see?
Oh, that's a tough one. Easy wins. Besides getting the I think we could get the Controlled Substance Act repealed in this year if people would just learn what it would take to do it. And that would be the best and fastest approach. But if they're not going to learn, and then basically treating the anxiety, I guess, would be the number one. Because the anxiety that people now have, because number one, they're gaslighted when they go to the doctor's office and have pain. They aren't treated properly. Their doses are dropped. But anxiety is one of the main drivers to create addiction. And we need to actually do something to help people with their anxiety. And I'm not talking benzodiazepines. Sorry, that's not the answer. Tapping, there's all kinds of alternative things. Tapping is, in fact, there's a tapping summit going on right now, but that's only this week of the first week of March. Tapping is way of reducing anxiety, using auricular therapy, just using some herbs. There are like St. John's wort and so on. There are ways of treating a person's anxiety to help them so that that's a major issue in our society today, period. That's causing a lot of the gun issues, that's causing the addiction problem. And so I think trying to come up with natural ways of treating anxiety and preventing anxiety. The other is, of course, because most of our problems are caused by our lifestyle, and just working on lifestyle changes that are more towards healing than any disease that we see today. Does that answer the question? Maybe.
I think so. It was good practical advice that anyone listening can implement. So I would consider that an easy win for sure. In the remaining few minutes, Dr. Cheek, can you let the audience know how they can get a hold of you and learn a little bit more about your work?
Sure. Main thing is to learn what is needed in order to get the Controlled Substance Act repealed. And to do that, if you go on any of my websites, I have three websites. The primary one pertaining to doctors and patients that are needing pain management is doctorsofcourage.org. I have videos on the video page, which is at the very end of the menu. And those videos have, for example, the real cause of drug abuse, which explains what is the real cause of drug abuse as far as lifestyle and toxicity. I have if you just sign up for my newsletter by going to any of the blogs and going to my author page, author box at the bottom, you can get the ebook, The Real Cause of Drug, I'm sorry, not that, that's the Using the Law Illegally Against Doctors, so that they can understand how the CSA is being used improperly. And then I also have my 7 Pillars of Total Health website, which is the website for my e-courses. I do have e-courses. I do not have any offered right now, but people really should learn how to take care of their own health. Just with the way the world is going today, you never know when there might not even be a pharmaceuticals or abilities to even get drugs in the future. So people do need to learn old-fashioned ways of dealing with their own health problems that we've basically forgotten over the last 50 years. And having me come to not come, virtual is better than live for me, but letting me do a presentation to any group, a business, a PTA, church, I'm available through virtual presentations to give a presentation on any subject pertaining to health, healing, alternative medicine, pain management, and so on. Just whatever a person be interested in learning, I can do a presentation. So those are my three websites. And just if you go to any of them, you'll find the directions to the other two. Doctors of Courage is what I would recommend people watching this video concentrate on.
Yeah, and I highly recommend you guys take a look at Doctors of Courage as well. And so with that, Dr. Cheek, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jay, for having me. Appreciate it.